On the latest episode of Into Music, singer-songwriter Adrian Sutherland takes us from Canada's Attawapiskat First Nation to Nashville.
I've only ever seen things like this in movies. I've never even left Canada, you know, before in my life. So these are just things that were always sort of far-fetched, and I don't think I'm ever going to get there or be that guy that ever makes it there.
That's Into Music every Thursday, available at KMUW.org and wherever you get your podcasts.
My name is Gina Chung, and the title of my short story collection is Green Frog.
Gina Chung's new short story collection, Green Frog, examines the Korean-American experience through a variety of perspectives and settings. Her stories weave real life with science fiction, resulting in a collection that touches on fear, pregnancy, and even sea creatures. I recently spoke with Gina Chung about these themes, her writing style, and how her characters continue to live on beyond the story. From KMUW Studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network, this is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay, and here's my conversation with Gina Chung. So how would you describe this collection? Were there requirements for each story to be considered for the collection?
Well, that's a great question. I would say that the stories in the collection all kind of hinge around sort of central themes, which include Korean girlhood and womanhood, animals, bodies, and of course, transformation. And I think that last bit is probably key to all of the stories, in that each of the characters that the reader will meet in the story are all kind of at a juncture or a crossroads in their life, and have to undergo some kind of transformation, whether it's an internal one, or in some cases, a very literal external one, in order to sort of get to the other side of that experience. And in terms of thinking about which stories made it into the collection, I mostly wanted to have this sort of theme kind of extend throughout the stories, and also for the reader to be able to kind of see, even across the different styles and the sort of magical versus realist elements, to see the ways in which these characters are sort of experiencing things and kind of a continuum of experiences, such as family, inheritances, ancestry, and of course, parent-child relationships, which is another major theme throughout the book.
In the first story in the collection, you write, "Getting to know the names of your elders is a luxury." And so many of these stories feature complex intergenerational relationships. Could you talk about why it felt like an important motif in the book? Why was this important?
I think it was really important for me to include that idea of not necessarily knowing specificities about your ancestors, because this is an experience that's definitely true for me in my own life. My family is Korean, my parents are immigrants. And while I'm sort of familiar with kind of the broad strokes of like the sort of lore of my family, so to speak, I didn't really grow up knowing the names of specific elders, of even aunts and uncles. I mean, all of that information is there, of course, but in Korean culture, there's often very specific titles for different relatives in your life, and it kind of all depends on age and whose side the relative is on. And so, you know, it's very easy to go your whole life without ever really having to know your grandmother's name, for example, or your great aunt's. And that was something I didn't realize was unusual until, you know, I was a little bit older growing up here in the States, and realized that, you know, for things like family tree projects, there were vast swaths of information that I just didn't know. And when I went to my parents to ask them about it, they were willing to share with me, but there was also a lot of kind of gaps of silence there, I think in part because of how painful it can be to sort of recall forgotten ancestors or relatives. And a lot of that is due in part to the legacy of the Korean War and the sort of separation and border crossing and migration that occurred for so many people across the Korean diaspora, not just in my own family. And as a writer, you know, of fiction especially, I'm always interested in sort of creating a coherent narrative wherever I can. And so I think in terms of thinking about my own family story, I was really fascinated by these gaps where I couldn't always make sense of things, or I didn't have access to information. And so that was something I wanted some of the characters in this collection to be grappling with as well.
You know, other than the obvious Korean connection, what jumped out to me were mentions of fear. Several stories feature protagonists who are full of fear, like in Rabbit Heart or Human Heart, where the Kamiho is first full of fear, and then by the end, they are alone and unafraid by the end of the story. Or, you know, another story describes fear as a golden arrow. Talk to me about this as a theme.
I think from a personal perspective, I find fear really interesting because it's often sort of thought of in a negative connotation, but, you know, I try to think about fear as sort of this neutral force. And it is one that, you know, for better or for worse, has been kind of a driving motivator for me in a lot of sort of like the drive to achieve, the drive to survive or sort of move through a difficult experience. You know, looking back, it's interesting to see how much of fear and resilience and strength, those are all kind of tied up. It's not always just this one kind of one note emotion. And it's interesting that you're identifying these characters as being people who experience fear, because they're also, you know, in the case of certainly in the narrator and Rabbit Heart, who's a child at the time of the story, they're all kind of still growing into their own selves and discovering who they are, getting comfortable in their own skin. And I think when you are someone who is really vulnerable like that, the world is a very fearful place to inhabit. And so by the end of those stories, I really wanted the reader to come away with an understanding that this is not someone who's never going to be afraid again, of course, but they've sort of come to the other side of a particular experience, usually through sort of having a different kind of understanding of where they come from, in order to no longer really feel that fear quite as much, so that it's no longer kind of haunting them at every step in their journey in the world.
So pregnancies seem to show up a lot as well. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny that you're mentioning that, because you're not the first person to have pointed out that as a recurring theme. And it's funny, when I was writing these stories and sort of knitting them together into this collection, it didn't really occur to me that that was like a frequent theme. But certainly motherhood and daughterhood are absolutely things that I think about a lot consciously and that appear a lot in my own writing. I am not a parent, but I am a daughter. And a lot of sort of my own understanding of daughterhood in general has sort of been inextricably tied to understanding who my parents were as kids and their own experiences of being children to their parents. With the experience of motherhood, I made the decision a while ago to not become a parent, but I do find the experience of parenting or being a parental figure in a child's life to be a very sort of fascinating and kind of transformative experience. And I'm at an age now where many of my friends are either having kids or starting to think about having kids. And so it's been a real joy to sort of be kind of this like aunt figure in a lot of these children's lives. And I guess it's got me thinking now that I'm in my 30s about what it would mean to sort of take on that experience and what it looks like to sort of create a new family, which is, there's a story in the collection that sort of refers to this. But I feel like family creating and making is sort of its own kind of beautiful and brave transformative act of storytelling. You're sort of creating a new narrative with creating and bringing in this new person into the world. And the lessons that you teach them and the stories you tell them sort of become really fundamental to what their journey looks like.
You know, I imagine that you didn't just sit down and write story after story after story all at once specifically for this collection. I mean, have you been working on this for a while?
Yeah, I would say I think the sort of official narrative that I've thought of in terms of the collection is that the collection as a whole has been sort of coming together over the course of maybe 4 years or so. But then I thought back and realized that some of these stories are actually much older than that. I think Human Hearts might be the oldest story in the collection, and that I started it maybe back in like 2016 or so. And at that point, in terms of my writing journey, I was writing on my own whenever I could, but I just didn't know enough about the craft and structure of storytelling, despite being a voracious reader. I didn't understand the mechanics of story enough. And I also didn't understand myself as a writer enough to sort of like carry it through all the way to the end. And so I had a lot of beginnings of stories. And then a few years later, I made the decision to apply for MFA programs. And in the program that I ended up going to, which was at the New School in New York City, I was very lucky enough to meet a lot of wonderful mentors and fellow classmates and got a chance to learn about craft and what it looks like to build a story, and how, you know, one of the most fundamental things in craft is this understanding that character builds plot and informs plot. And that was something I just like had not even thought of in that way. And so a lot of these stories have been coming together for quite some time. And even the ones that are newer do come from a place of like wondering and questions that I've been asking myself for some time, including questions on grief, the questions of what we owe to ourselves versus the ones we love, especially our families of origin. These are things that really kind of haunt and perennially interest me as a writer. And so the collection sort of reflects those kinds of organic interests that have really grown and sort of expanded over time.
I'm assuming you have some sort of connection to sea creatures? I mean, your first book, your first novel was titled Sea Change, and it hit the world by storm. And I noticed there were quite a few sea creatures in this collection. Is that right?
Yeah, I think it's funny. I don't have like a sort of biological connection to sea creatures. I remember when Sea Change first came out, you know, a couple people asked me if I'd ever like worked in an aquarium. And I was like, no, God, I wish, dream job. but no, I've always been fascinated by certainly the ocean, because I think it's like the closest that we can get on sort of this terrestrial plane to experiencing like what creatures from another planet might be like, just because the ocean is just full of so many wonders, horrors, maybe, and just things that are so mysterious to us. And I'm actually very afraid of the ocean, which I think is why I have such a reverence and kind of fascination for it. And then I think a lot of the sort of creatures that appear in this collection are also sort of reflections of interests I have in the natural world. For example, there's a praying mantis in the short story Mantis in the collection, who, you know, it's sort of a playful kind of whimsical story, but it's about a female praying mantis who just can't stop killing her boyfriends, the people that she meets. And she's sort of like, this is sort of what she's programmed to do. But at the same time, I wondered, what would it look like for an animal that is programmed to be this sort of lethal killing machine to maybe also feel lonely and think about connection? And that's a sort of theme in some of the stories that are also more about like magical creatures, such as the Kumiho that you referenced in Human Hearts.
These stories, they all felt like real and raw, but then they would have twists like that, like you suggested. And then perhaps there was even a little bit of science fiction involved with some of these stories. Can you talk to me about the science fiction, bringing that into it? But then also I'm curious, I mean, all of these stories, including the Praying Mantis and the Human Heart, do they all have a female perspective, or am I remembering incorrectly?
Yeah, I think that they almost all have female protagonists at the heart of them. The one exception would probably be The Sound of Water, which is about a sort of former hometown hero who's come home to help out at his parents' store in a small town in New Jersey. In the two stories that I think are probably the most explicitly kind of science fiction-esque, they're called Presence, and the other one is Attachment Processes. I've always sort of been interested in the ways in which technology and new developments in that area almost kind of mimic magic, or at least our understanding of magic from years past. And in thinking about sort of the central kind of problems, the quote unquote problems that the protagonists experience in each of those stories, one of which is dealing with memories of traumas past, and the other one is dealing with grief. I wondered, you know, if there will ever be a sort of device or technology that would allow us to kind of like, quote unquote, solve and deal with those things. Because that is one of those things that the world in which we live in, we sort of seem to be presented with so-called solutions to our many problems as humans. And yet, you know, it is a bit of a cliche, but I think it is true to say that a lot of these new solutions also in themselves pose new problems. And so I was really interested in this question of how do these fundamental experiences of processing or not processing trauma and grief, how would they sort of be understood in a kind of late capitalist techno space where, you know, now there's an opportunity to sort of deal with these problems. And, you know, the protagonists in these stories are people who feel like they are so uncomfortable with the sort of suffering that they've experienced that they're willing to kind of almost do anything to, or try anything to sort of circumvent those experiences. So I think in thinking about those devices or the sort of technologies that I invented for these stories, I was very interested in how real life people might attempt to sort of solve these things. And I do think it's true that there's a line in Presence where the protagonist muses to herself that you can never go broke, you know, underestimating people's unwillingness to feel uncomfortable. And I do think that is a true thing in today's day and age.
Some of your stories feel like they end before they arrive at a full conclusion for their characters, which leaves the reader anticipating or, you know, continuing to think about these characters long beyond the page. What is your approach or method to constructing endings for your stories?
Endings, I feel, are something that I always kind of, I love thinking about endings because the process for coming up with an ending sort of looks different for me with every new piece of writing, whether it's like a longer project or a short story. Sometimes with a short story, if I'm really lucky, I can actually picture either the ending image or an ending note that I want the story to end on. And what I typically do is I'll write like a very quick summary for myself or just a few lines to remind myself of what that ending should be. And maybe 7 times out of 10, it ends up staying. And sometimes it ends up surprising me, which is always interesting as a writer when something comes up on the page. And you're like, oh, wait, I think I should actually follow that. And in terms of what you noticed about the stories, I am sort of very interested as a writer and as a person too, just generally, I think in the moments right before or the moments right after a big sort of maybe even cataclysmic thing has occurred in a character's life. So, you know, if a character is making a decision, for example, to leave their partner, I'm very interested in not just what the leaving looks like, but also what the decision to leave might look like as well. And sometimes in the case of some of the stories, the characters make a decision to not make a decision, which in itself is sort of a choice as well and has reverberations, you know, long after the actual story has ended.
Do you ever think about your characters beyond where they end for us on the page?
I do. There are some characters in the collection that I definitely think have gone on to do other things that I do wonder about. And there are some characters where I think maybe they ended up trying to stay in that sort of static moment that we ended with. But I think that they all kind of exist in this sort of weird extended universe in my head. I don't know if I will revisit all of them or maybe even any of them, but they are all part of like different sort of aspects of people I've been or people that I've thought about becoming in some ways.
Your stories take place in Korea, New York, California, Texas. Are these locations meaningful to you?
Yeah, I'm from New Jersey myself. I was actually born in New York City originally, and then my parents moved us to the suburbs of New Jersey when I was really young. And so I always say that, you know, New Jersey is my home state since that's where I spent a lot of my formative years. But in writing the stories in this collection, I didn't necessarily want to set all of the stories in locations that I was just familiar with. One of the stories is set in Texas, as you mentioned, and that was inspired from a trip I took to Austin a couple years ago, where I got to see for the first time this sort of like amazing phenomenon in Austin where there are a bunch of bats living in a colony on Congress Avenue Bridge. I think it's something like the largest city within city limits bat colony in the world. And I sort of got to see that sort of phenomenon of the bats flying out at sunset to go hunt. And I was just so struck by how beautiful and kind of magical the experience was. And there were like crowds of people there. So I also thought it was kind of very cool to see a bunch of people gathered for that specific purpose, to watch a bunch of bats fly out into the world. And I was also thinking about, you know, what it would mean whenever I'm in a new city. I can't help but imagine, you know, what it would be like to live here. And I was thinking about what it would have been like to have grown up in a place like Texas or in Southern California, where some of the other characters grew up, or in Korea and some of the other stories. And, you know, where I'm from in New Jersey, there is a fairly strong like diaspora of Korean and Korean Americans, especially in Bergen County, where I'm from. And it wasn't until I was maybe a little older that I realized that there were so many other pockets of Korean American community around the states, including, of course, in LA, certainly in Texas, parts of the Midwest. And now that I am older and living in New York City, I always sort of think about what it would mean, what it would have looked like to have grown up in a very different region, as someone who identifies as being like very much a Northeastern person. So in terms of thinking about these locations, a lot of them were reflections of like my own kind of curiosities and also thinking about areas in which the Korean American community has sort of made a home for themselves.
How do you decide on perspective? Like in The Fruits of Sin, you used a first person plural, I believe, and I love the line. Other than Mrs. Parks Phillip, most of our children were unremarkable in the ways they disappointed us. Or there's a second person perspective from the love song of the Mexican free-tailed bat. How do you decide who will best tell the story and how that story is delivered?
Yes, for The Fruits of Sin, I think that was my first sort of attempt at writing a first person plural story. And I studied the POV in a class that I was taking in my MFA program, and we talked sort of about the pros and cons of each perspective, the limitations, and also the strengths within those limitations. And in terms of thinking about the first person plural, it's almost always a voice that lends itself to a lot of like kind of sly humor, because there are moments in which you can really get away with sort of a statement like that in terms of, you know, what a community is or isn't willing to abide, or sort of what the expectations are. But I also found that breaking away from the first person plural in that story in moments, whether it was to sort of focus more closely on one of the ladies in the story, or to focus more on this member of their church that they're all kind of observing, that's also really powerful and interesting whenever you break away from the sort of bounds of a particular POV. And with second person, I think that particular story came from a moment when I was reading a lot of Laurie Moore, who is like the queen of second person. And I remember learning from a teacher in my MFA program that the second person is a really good POV, a really effective POV, I should say, for exploring difficult moments in a whether it's in a character's life or in their memories. And I found it really interesting in terms of unlocking new memories or experiences that this character was able to access. I think I had tried actually writing it in first person originally and then considered changing it maybe halfway through, but it just didn't really lend itself to the same kind of almost confessional quality that I felt like the story needed. And so when I'm thinking about POV and the type of story I want to tell, it almost always comes down to the character and who the protagonist is for me. And if it's someone who is maybe a little bit afraid to sort of look at themselves, I think second person is really effective for that. And first person is a POV that I'm often quite comfortable in. So I think a lot of the stories are in that mode in the collection. Ultimately, I just want the reader to feel as close to the character as they can be. And that can also happen through third person, which sort of gives you a lot of latitude and freedom in terms of describing what's happening around the character. But yeah, I think a lot of times it comes down to thinking about who this character is and what they would or wouldn't want the reader to know.
I'm in a short story reading group started during the shutdown, and we meet on Zoom. We're located all across the country, and we meet every 2 weeks and discuss one story. And it seems that wherever we acquire the story, whether it's The New Yorker or, you know, maybe Best American Short Stories or perhaps the author's collection, each of us, we have a different story because they've been changed here and there. When you, like, I know some of these stories have appeared in journals and now you have this collection. Are they the same stories, or do you consider your stories finished when you write them, or do you continually tweak them?
That's a great question. Yeah, I think it is. And it's something I have wondered about too, in terms of these stories and sort of thinking about their form as they appear in the collection versus the forms they've appeared in journals that they've been published in. I think a lot of the stories do reflect like small tweaks here and there that came about through the editing process. Just because, you know, you're working with different editors, whether it's at a journal versus at a publishing company. And they're not sort of like hugely noticeable, I think, across the board. There's maybe one or two stories where my editor and I, for this book, talked about how to reach new beats in the end of the stories. And so we tried like sort of adding new lines, and I would go back and kind of write into the ending in order to sort of get to a more comfortable kind of landing place. Just because I think the experience of reading, and I do think the experience of reading a story as part of a collection is different from reading a story in, say, a journal or The New Yorker or a magazine that you find. And I think that experience was really helpful, not just in terms of the individual stories, but also in making the collection feel a lot more unified as a whole, since it is a sort of collection that the reader is encountering. Regarding thinking about if stories are ended, I do often feel, you know, I think I have a sort of completionist mindset. So whenever I finish anything, I'm like, that's it, you know? But it ends up that I do end up revisiting it, whether even if it's just sort of like in thinking about like, oh, could this story have ended differently? Or if it's someone on the outside who's kind of encouraging me, such as an editor, to think about it differently. I do find that revisiting things unlocks new ideas and sort of new inclinations artistically. I mean, I love writers and filmmakers or even musicians who are self-referential in that way, especially once they've amassed quite a large body of work. I find it really interesting when someone is able to revisit what feels like familiar territory and maybe have something new to say as a result of that.
Talk to me about the differences for you of novel writing versus short story writing. Is there one that you prefer over the other?
I think they're both really rewarding and challenging in different ways. When I was working on my novel Sea Change, I was also working concurrently on some of these short stories, and it sort of felt like I was quote unquote cheating on the novel in order to like play with these sort of shorter, maybe slightly less demanding pieces. I think I am someone who does really enjoy having more than one project to kind of toggle back and forth between. I think there's a sort of energy that's created in going from one project to another. And for me, I think one of the things I really love about the novel form that you don't really get in the short story form just because of the length is just being able to kind of luxuriate in the world that you've created, and sort of think about the world outside of your immediate protagonist in a really kind of comprehensive way. Like that's something I really enjoy doing. With short stories, though, the thing I love about them is that you get to play a little bit more. At least I feel like I get to play a little bit more. And I don't know if I'll ever write a novel, for example, in the first person plural, just because I don't think it's a POV that would lend itself for me personally to that length of a story. But I really enjoy playing with it for the short story form. And I think a short story also allows you to have a little bit more liberty with endings that are maybe a little bit more unusual, a little bit more experimental, or maybe end on a slightly more inconclusive note, just because, you want the reader to see the character at this particular moment or series of moments in time. Whereas a novel, I think you do, or at least I feel this way, there is a sort of narrative obligation to kind of see the character through a more kind of complete journey.
Do you have a favorite story in the collection?
It's hard to say because it feels like being asked to like pick a favorite
Right.
among my children or something like that. There were some stories that were definitely more fun or easier to write than others. The story Mantis, for example, this like never happens, but it sort of just came out of me in one kind of spurt of writing one day. And it actually came just a few days after I actually saw a praying mantis at like a random rest stop in upstate New York while on a road trip with my family. And I was just kind of like, what are you doing here? And then I couldn't stop thinking about it and then just sat down to write a short story about a mantis. And I don't think that there were even that many edits to it afterwards, after I started submitting it to journals and then eventually included it in the collection. But that never really happens. It's always a gift whenever it does. That one was really kind of like a joy to sort of just discover on the page. And there are other short stories in the collection that were much more difficult to write. For example, The Love Song of the Mexican Free-Tailed Bat is a story about a daughter who's sort of confronting the realities of her relationship with a father that some people would definitely consider abusive. And that story was, it was difficult to write in that I wanted to sort of give justice to her experiences, but also I wanted to show the ways in which the more positive experiences of her relationship with her father were kind of like how those two things sort of stood out in stark relief from one another. And I think that was challenging too, to sort of try and give complexity to this very, at times, quite difficult relationship. But I do feel like that story maybe is one of the most tender for me to revisit, especially because I think it was one of the first longer short stories I ever completed. So yeah, I think those two probably stand out for me.
Okay, so as an author, do you get to have any say in the cover design of your book? Because I was actually looking at the US cover versus the UK cover, and that's coming out a little bit later. And I looked at that for Sea Change as well, because they have different covers. How do you feel about the different covers for Green Frog?
Yeah, they're very different. I love them both. I think they're both really striking in very different ways. I think I saw the US cover design for Green Frog first, just because it's coming out now in March and the UK edition isn't coming out until June. And this was one of the first designs that my publisher showed me. And I loved the sort of the verdantness of the cover. It's got a beautiful collage of a frog on the cover. And it just felt really apt to me in terms of thinking about the themes of like nature and sort of the kind of the folkloric elements that are definitely a part of the collection. The UK edition, for those who haven't seen, is very different. It actually doesn't feature a frog on the cover. It has a praying mantis on the cover with a girl kind of sitting on top of it, like they're about to like go off on an adventure together. And I loved it. It was just so unexpected and interesting. And the vibes for the two editions, also for Sea Change, are quite different as well. And I trust that. I think a lot of it is like maybe just the way books are marketed in different areas of the world. So I just feel really grateful that the books get to have sort of different clothes as they enter different parts of the world and get to meet new readers. I feel like with the cover design process for both books, I was definitely, I felt like it was a very good experience overall in that I came to my publisher with some ideas. I made a kind of a mood board of images that spoke to me or that I thought felt were in line with the collection. And then during the sort of process of putting together designs, I'm so not like a visually inclined person, so that whenever I do get to see the work of a designer, I'm always so thrilled to kind of see how that work. And I think it's an incredibly difficult job too, like book cover design. I'm always so thrilled to see how some of those ideas can be translated in a form that I might not even have thought of.
So talk to me about the title, Green Frog.
So the title comes from the title story, which is called Green Frog. And that's a story that is sort of based on the Korean fable of the green frog, or Jeonggaeguri. And it's a sort of cautionary tale told to children to get them to obey their parents. Long story short, it's about a little green frog who always does the opposite of what his mother tells him to do. And then, you know, kind of pays dearly for that sort of disobedience. And in this short story, Green Frog, that I wrote, it's about a character who is kind of grappling with not having lived up to parental expectations in the wake of her mother's death. And she's sort of at this point in her life where she has to really kind of decide for herself what kind of life she wants outside of these sorts of expectations that have been kind of sort of enclosing her life up until that point. So I really liked that sort of idea of contending with what it means to be a quote unquote disobedient or wayward child. And I think the concerns in that story are reflective across a lot of the stories in the collection in terms of thinking about parent-child relationships, what we inherit, and what we might owe to ourselves versus to each other.
Well, the story collection is Green Frog. Gina Chung, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Gina Chung, author of the book Green Frog, which was published by Knopf. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR Podcast Network. Our engineers are Mark Statzer and Torin Anderson. Our editors are Luann Stevens and Haley Krausen. Our producers are Haley Krausen and Katie Lanning, and our marketing coordinator is Carly Cooper. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Goulet.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.